You would open your Bibles to Psalm 3. John and Scott stood on the deck of a ship in the British Royal Navy. It was September of 1814. The war that is commonly known as the War of 1812. The battle with the British had been particularly painful for the United States. The Capitol, White House, and Washington had been burned. The British were invading ports along the Atlantic coast. And in September of 1814, they were intent on taking the harbor at Baltimore. In the night of September the 13th, they were shelling Fort McHenry, a defensive fort protecting Baltimore. John and Scott were on the deck of that British ship, not because they were in alliance with the British, but they stood there as faithful American patriots. They were there on a mission that had been sanctioned by the President of the United States to try to secure the release of an older doctor who had been faithful in serving his community and even serving wounded British soldiers. This doctor had been taken captive by the British, and so John and Scott had gone to the ship to try to secure his release. They were, with documents written by wounded British soldiers bragging on and praising this doctor for his efforts to help them, they were able to secure the release of the doctor that they were there to help. But because they knew some things about the impending invasion or attack on Baltimore, they would not allow John and Scott to leave the ship until the battle was over. So they stood on the deck of that ship and watched the bombardment of that fort. It was a rainy, dreary evening and morning. The rainy weather flag was flying in the fort, and periodically as the explosions went off, they could see the flag flying over the port. The wee hours of the morning, the shelling stopped. They didn't know what that meant. Did that mean they had lost the battle and the fort had been taken? Or did it mean they had won victory? They would have to wait for the dawn. For it was only with the dawn, the coming of the morning, they would learn if it would be a morning of hope or a morning of despair. As we turn to the third psalm, we also look and a man who looked to the morning. A man who wondered if he would see the morning. And when he saw the morning, he saw hope. Would you join with me in reading Psalm 3? O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield to me, my glory, and the one who lifts my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and He answered me from His holy mountain. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for You have smitten all my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessings be upon your people. For just a few moments this morning, I want us to focus on the third psalm as we continue to think about our awesome God. The last few weeks, we have dealt with the two paths of life. The path of the wise, the path of righteousness, and the other path, the path of wickedness. In Psalm 1, we talked about the individual choice that each of us have to make. Will we be like a tree planted by rivers of water, or will we be like the chaff which blows away in the wind? In the second Psalm, we talked about how not only individuals, as the first chapter talks about, but in the second Psalm, we talked about how nations have to make a choice on which path they will walk in. As we come to the third Psalm, we are dealing with both individuals and a nation making that choice. Will they walk in the ways of the Lord? Will they continue to serve under the king that has been anointed by God? Or will they rebel and take things into their own hands? The individuals in the nation have to decide, and the nation itself does. If you look at the scripture or postscript at the beginning of the third psalm, it specifically says a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. And as you look at these words which begin the psalm, it gives us the setting potentially of what this song is about. It is set with the events that are found in the book of Samuel. And you're going to find as we go through this, and it should, we'll have up on the screen, we'll be going back and forth. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the circumstances, the confidence, and the call. And as we look at the circumstances, the confidence, and the call, I want to go back and forth from Psalm 3 to 2 Samuel chapters 15 and following. And I want us to see how the psalm parallels what's going on in the story in David's life. I think it's over 70 of these psalms have some kind of little introductory comment right before the song begins. Also, 13 of the psalms are attributed to some event in David's life. And when it talks about a psalm of David, the word can mean of David, for David, by David. These psalms can either be written by David himself, can be written in honor of him, etc., but they're connected to David in some way. And so this psalm is connected to the rebellion of Absalom against his father. So if you would, join with me as we talk about the circumstances, the confidence, and the call. Let us begin with the circumstances. David begins in Psalm 3 talking about his adversaries having increased. They have surrounded him. They're rising up. And they're not only rising up against him, but they're mockingly saying, okay, where is God now? God's not going to be able to help him. He is overcome. And so his enemies not only close in on him, but they're certain of victory. If you look over in 2 Samuel chapter 15, if you start looking around verses 10 and following, you're beginning to see an uprising by Absalom. Hints of it have been taking place earlier. Absalom has been secretly behind David's back, been trying to win support in the city. For example, when people would go to the king, if they had some problem that they need to discuss with the king, if they needed some official verdict from the king, if they needed the king to make a decision in an argument between people, they would be on their way to see the king to get him to judge in the matter at hand. Well, Absalom would meet them on the way and say, basically, you'll never get justice from this king, but now if I were reigning in Jerusalem, I guarantee you everybody would get justice. Everybody would be listened to. And so he's in a not-so-subtle way, he has been promoting himself and has been undermining the leadership of his father. And he has been quietly gathering together forces. And so what is happening is, as we get in chapter 15, verse 10 and following, he's basically gathered together his support and he is marching on the city. If you look at what is found in verse 12, it says, Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, Adam's counselor from his city of Gilah, while he was offering sacrifices, and the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. The involvement of Ahithophel in this rebellion is huge, because Ahithophel was one of the key inner circle in the kingdom of David. It's one of his key advisors. It's, you know, basically like taking his vice president or one of his cabinet members. And so this was a big deal that Ahithophel went with Absalom. And so things were so desperate and so bad that what David does there in verses 13 and 14 is that David says to those who are his followers, his family, and loyal to him, we must leave the city. If we don't leave the city, we will perish in the city. And I think not only was David concerned for his family, but he did not want bloodshed in the city. He makes the statement that the city will be put to the sword, and he didn't want it to happen in the city of Jerusalem. And so you have this sad picture that takes place in the rest of this chapter in which David and his family walk out of the city. You can look over, for example, in chapter 15. You might look in verse 30. And basically, David and the people are weeping as they leave the city. He's taking off his sandals or his shoes, and he's walking barefoot up the side of the mountain on the far side of the brook Kidron. And as they're walking up the hill there on the eastern side of the city of Jerusalem, they are weeping and mourning. I want you to think about David. Here's a man in the latter years of his life, a man many years into his reign, at a time when he ought to be able to enjoy the fruits of his labors, ought to be able to enjoy the peace of his kingdom. I mean, he's had the battles in the past. He's fought against the Goliaths. He's fought against the Philistines. He's fought against Saul's family as they tried to take the throne back for their family. He's been through all of that, and you would hope that those battles were behind him and that he could enjoy a little peace. But here he is walking out of the city in shame, literally running for his life. And he and his family and his closest followers and closest servants weep as they walk up the hill out of Jerusalem. And what I want you to think about as he has this sense that literally his enemies are closing in on him, I want you to think about why he's there. He's there for a lot of different reasons. He's there because there are some people who are connected to Saul and his family. Remember, when Saul and Jonathan died, David took the throne. And so there were still people in Israel who were upset about the fact that Saul's family didn't stay on the throne. That David, some viewed still David as a usurper who took the throne. And so you have, any time there was a potential rebellion, you would have folks connected to Saul and his family that would get involved. You have just some evil and mean people. There are just some wicked and power-hungry people in the world. You also have betrayal. You have the betrayal of a son. You have the betrayal of some closest friends. And what you find, I find of interest is, as you look at chapters 15 and 16 of 2 Samuel, you really have people choosing sides. And it's in times of crisis that you really find out who your friends are. And that's when David finds out. You know, there are a lot of folks that say, "Oh, you're a great person. I really think a lot of you. You're my friend. I really like you. I'll stand by you through thick and thin." But then, when thick and thin comes, they're not there. When it gets tough, when tough decisions have to be made, when sacrifices have to be made, when they have to make a stand against what is maybe popular, or what is politically correct or socially correct, however you want to put it, then those who said they were your friends but really aren't, they run. And that's exactly what happened to David. There were people he thought he could count on that ran away, that sided with his son. There were also others, and we could spend all day talking about the stories of all the people involved in this rebellion on one side or the other. There were others who had every reason to side with Absalom, every reason not to go with David. But they stuck with David, even if it meant the loss of their homes, their families, their positions, and their lives. In this, you have the betrayal, not only of family, you have the betrayal of a trusted advisor, Ahithophel. I don't know that there's any pain that comes any more dearly than the pain of betrayal by close friends and family. In other words, I think David isn't surprised that there are evil people out there that wanted to take his throne. There's always evil people. But when it's in your own household, and when it's among your dearest friends, your confidants with whom you've shared things you wouldn't share with anybody else, it had to feel like a dagger in his heart. And maybe, just maybe, that's why he wept so much as he walked up the side of that mountain. But also, part of this is his fault. See, David made a decision to break marriage vows, to commit adultery with Bathsheba. He also plotted in the murder of Bathsheba's wife, her husband, Uriah. And it set in play a chain of events that led to this. This story is another domino in a line of dominoes that began falling, in which he had a son that raped his half-sister. That half-sister was the full sister of Absalom. Absalom then kills the brother who raped the half-sister. Through all of this, David does very little or almost nothing. Absalom is banished from Jerusalem for a time, then allowed back. And through all of this, David exercises very little control. In fact, when you look at 1 Kings chapter 1, you have another son trying to take over the throne, a son named Adonijah. And it says of Adonijah, basically his daddy never told him no. My guess is the reason that he probably never told his children no, and one of the reasons he probably never corrected the kids for things they did, is because that many of the things he would have had to have corrected his kids for, he was guilty of. When they commit sexual immorality and he needed to punish them, he didn't, because he had committed sexual immorality. When they committed murder and he needed to take a stand, he didn't, because he had been guilty in the murder of Uriah. And so he'd let his children basically run out of control. He's always to realize that he's here in part because of just evil people. He's here in part because of betrayal by family and friends. But he's here in part because of some decisions he made in his own past that are coming back to haunt him. And so you have not only the enemies that are out there, but I think you have the overwhelming guilt of things done in days gone by. And as he deals with that, is he going to be overwhelmed or is he going to stay strong? It's in times of crisis we find out if our faith is real. Look at David's response. Look at his confidence he puts in God. He says, "But you, O Lord, are a shield about me." Throughout this, he has military images all through, especially from verse 3 onward. He says, "The Lord, even though I am surrounded, I'm surrounded by betrayal. I'm surrounded by evil. I'm surrounded by the guilt of my own misdeeds. And as these darts fly through the air, as these spears and these swords aim at my heart and soul, you are my shield. I still trust in you. I still believe in you." Because of the heartbreak of betrayal, because of the guilt of knowing that he, had he acted differently, might not be here. He could have been overwhelmed. But he trusted not only in the greatness of his God, but in the mercy and forgiveness of his God. And so he said, "You are my shield, my glory, the one who lifts my head." The idea is lifting up in victory, not cowering in shame, but lifted up in joy. He said, I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and He answered me from His holy mountain. And here's what I want you to see in verse 5. "I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me." Now, there are some events that we need to look at back in 2 Samuel that help us to see why David would make that statement. Absalom marches into the city. He takes over the city. He takes over the position of king. He takes over the palace. Now he's got to decide, what does he do next? Does he leave David? As long as David, his father, lives, then he is a threat. How is he going to deal with his father? He can't just let him run amok. Eventually he'll gather up forces and come back on him. Ahithophel has some counsel for him. And let me share with you something that I think is of interest. It is believed, based on some genealogies given in the text, that Ahithophel is Bathsheba's grandfather. Remember, Bathsheba is the one that David committed adultery with. Remember, it's Bathsheba's husband that David is guilty of killing. And so that may well have laid the background for Ahithophel's rebellion. He may have joined with Absalom in rebellion as a way to get back at David for destroying the marriage of his granddaughter and the life of his granddaughter's husband. Ahithophel was a trusted advisor of David, and now he's a trusted advisor of Absalom. And so basically, Absalom's not sure what to do next. And so Ahithophel says, "Let me take 12,000 men. And while David's on the run, while he's tired and exhausted and overwhelmed and discouraged, he says, basically, let me chase him down before the night is over and let me take his life. Because if we can get David, we win. The people will melt if we can get David. Now, what is interesting is you not only have Ahithophel giving advice, a traitor, but you also have Hushai, H-U-S-H-A-I, a man who is also a former advisor of David and has now gone to Absalom saying, like Ahithophel, now I'll side with you and help you. But the difference between Hushai and Ahithophel is a traitor. Hushai is a spy for David. And so what happens is they both give advice. Ahithophel says, let me take an army right now before sunrise and let me catch David while he's weak and tired and let me kill him. Hushai, when he's asked what to do, says, you know, this time Ahithophel is wrong. The implication is, normally he's right, but I think that's not the best advice now. He says, you need to remember that David is a great and crafty warrior. My guess is he's not even with the people now. He's probably hidden off in a cave somewhere. And if you go and try to attack the people and he's not there, he may well lead a sneak attack or a counterattack. And if he gains any kind of victory and word gets back to the city, then it is going to demoralize your followers. So what was intended to demoralize the followers of David can actually backfire on us. And so he says, I don't recommend you do anything tonight. He says, what I recommend you do is just wait. Because all Israel is going to come to help you. Just wait till the morning. Let everybody come and help you. Folks from all over the kingdom are going to gather to you. And when they're all gathered together, then you can get David. And he also says something that I think is of interest. In the end of verse 11, and that you personally go into battle. He says, in other words, don't just send Ahithophel, but he says, wait till the army gathers around you and you lead the army to take David. That's the best way to do it. And what happens is Absalom listens to the advice of Hushai and does not listen to the advice of Ahithophel. Now, with that in mind, I want us to go back and look at the third psalm. Look at what he says in the third psalm. He says, I lay down and slept. Ahithophel wanted to lead an army to take him in the night. Ahithophel wanted to make sure that he never saw the morning. But because Absalom didn't listen to Ahithophel, but instead listened to Hushai, David is able to say, I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. And when he woke up in the morning, when he had made it through the night, he saw hope with the dawn. The Lord has delivered me through the night. I didn't know if I'd live to see sunrise. But I am alive to see sunrise. And the Lord who got me through the night can get me through the day. And he says, I will put my trust in the Lord. I will trust that He'll shield me from my enemies. And it doesn't matter if 10,000 warriors of Absalom come upon me. I am convinced that my God will deliver me. And so based on that confidence, in spite of the dire circumstances, he calls on the Lord. And the opening line in this next section is what was commonly a battle cry in ancient Israel when they went into battle. Arise, O Lord! Save me, O my God! For you have smitten all my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. He said, I'm convinced that the God who got me through the night can get me through the day. Lord, please arise and help us in battle. And as our story continues from 2 Samuel, just as Hushai had hoped, Absalom waited. He gathered together his forces. He led those forces into battle. The armies of David went to meet the forces of Absalom in battle. And the army of David was victorious. You know the story of how Absalom was riding upon his mule and his head was caught in a tree. The soldier of the army of David found him there and told Joab, and Joab and some of the inner circle of soldiers around him gathered around Absalom and killed him. In verse 17 of chapter 18, it says, they took Absalom and threw him in a pit and piled up stones on him. And you have an interesting contrast. Verse 18 of that same chapter says Absalom had built a monument in honor of himself. And so symbolically in verse 17, it says basically Joab and the other soldiers built another monument, a pile of stones on his dead body. That when a man sets out to glorify himself instead of God, the glory that he shall be known for is a pile of stones over his feeble efforts. And so you have something powerful here. If you look back in verse 14 of chapter 17, it says, "The counsel of Hushai, the Archite, is better than the counsel of Ahithophel." That was the conclusion Absalom came to. That's why there was no attack in the night. That's why David lived to the morning. But I want you to notice what's important about the statement. In the last of verse 14, "For the Lord had ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel." Military-wise, the Ahithophel counsel was best. But God thwarted his efforts. Why? Because David put his confidence in God. And David called on God for help. Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, "Please let me run and bring the king news that the Lord has freed him from the hand of his enemies." Verse 19 of chapter 18. The message of the story of Absalom is that if you will put your trust in God, God has the power to deliver. And what you read in Psalm 3 is David's description of what happened in that story. "My circumstances were that I was surrounded by my enemies, but God brought me through the night to the dawn, and when I saw the sunrise, I said, I will put my trust in God. I will put confidence in Him and let Him shield me. And so now, Lord, let us go into battle." Picture David saying, "Rise, O Lord," the battle cry of Israel, as his soldiers are about to march out to try to take his kingdom back. And the Lord did arise. And the Lord did go with that army. And the Lord did give him the victory. Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? The next morning, the sun rose. Scott was able to see Fort McHenry. And not only did he see a flag, but it wasn't the rain flag or the smaller flag of the night before. But it was a huge 42-foot-long American flag flying over the fort. They'd originally made the flag so big to make sure that the British could see it from far out at sea. And as he saw that flag flying over that fort, still there on the deck of a ship from the British Royal Navy, he pulled out a letter that he kept in his pocket and he started writing a poem on the back of that letter. On September the 16th, they finally released him on shore in Baltimore, and that night in a hotel room there in Baltimore, he finished his poem, complete with four stanzas. He then took the poem and gave it to his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law loved it and set about getting it published. It was eventually in short order in 17 newspapers around the country. Eventually, they then took that poem and they put it to music. Ironically, the music they used was a well-known, a popular British pub song, a drinking song. In time, its name changed from the Battle of Fort McHenry. It came to be called the Star-Spangled Banner. In 1889, the U.S. Navy began using it for official ceremonies. In 1916, it was used basically for all military ceremonies. In 1931, it officially became our national anthem. When I hear or sing the Star-Spangled Banner, I need to see Francis Scott Key standing on the deck of that ship, waiting for the sun to come up, wondering, is the flag going to be up or is it going to be the British flag? Will it be despair or hope? That song is an emblem of hope for a country. But as I think about that, I want you, the next time you hear the Star-Spangled Banner, I don't want you to think about that song. I want you to think about Psalm 3. Because it's also a song. A song written 2,000 years ago by a king. A king who had his nation ripped away from him. A king betrayed and hunted, living with the ghost of his own guilt, who didn't know if he would see the dawn. But when he saw the sun come up, he was convinced that his God would deliver him. And he put his trust in that God. The next time you feel surrounded, even if it's your own fault, because all of us are going to be there. There are going to be times in life when we face horrible things, and sometimes it will be of our own doing. Or if you're betrayed by a friend, whatever it happens in your life to help you feel overwhelmed, look to the dawn. You think of the times you went to bed at night with a problem you thought you couldn't defeat, but you slept a few hours and you woke up the next morning and you said, okay, we can do this. That's exactly what David did. And if we'll put our trust in the Lord, He can help us overcome anything. If you're not a child of God, it is my prayer that you'll express your faith in repentance, confession, and baptism this morning. Because it's only through being a child of God that you and I can have hope in the morning. For those of us who are children of God, I hope that we'll renew our confidence and trust in God. And if there's a barrier between us and God in any way, let's make it right now that we might have hope as we stand and sing.